So when we turn to the biblical texts, we know fundamentally that the Bible is not necessarily always concerned about sex. We think it is. The Bible actually talks more about money than it does about sex. However, there are texts all the way through that help us understand what the biblical ancestors were on about. Namely, many texts are concerned about purity and cleanliness. Some texts speak about the trappings of sex, how it is specifically expressed by the neighbors, namely in the pagan fertility cults. What the neighbors were doing in their worship in those pagan cults was going contrary to what was happening for the people of Israel. Many of the rules set down are saying, do not do what the neighbors do. We have a different way of doing it. At times, the Bible talks very candidly about sex and about sexuality. But in most places, it's almost like it's codified. No different than a father or a mother sitting under a tree on a hot afternoon in PEI who does their very best to try and explain how it all works without using graphic language, but simple language that everybody understands. You will never find in the biblical text the word that we know as penis or vagina. It does not appear. Instead, when we listen and we watch for words in biblical texts, we will hear often for males, flesh. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin. You shall make for them linen breeches to cover their naked flesh from the loins to the thighs. And sometimes the reference of flesh actually means sexual intercourse. So when we read the text, we have to think about what's going on. When you hear the flesh, sometimes we make and jump to conclusions. In the New Testament, in the Gospel of Mark, a man shall be joined with his wife and become one flesh. Sometimes the word body also suggests sexual intercourse, as in 1 John chapter 2. Paul talks about genitalia this way, our unpresentable parts. And he says, which are supposed to be treated with greater modesty. Also terms like loin, thigh, or side, or feet can be used as signs of male genitalia. Ruth uncovered the feet of Boaz. You probably never heard that version in Sunday school. Often, too, for female genitalia is also feet or nakedness. Her nakedness was uncovered. Sometimes these terms are used shamefully, and sometimes they are used with delight. Also, the word womb is also sometimes in biblical texts suggestive not just of reproduction, but of sexual intercourse. Sexual relationships in the biblical texts are often prescribed in terms of how to or not to or when to or with whom you shall not. But then every once in a while we hear those delightful texts like the Song of Songs. How beautiful you are and how pleasing, my love, with your delights. Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. May your breasts be like clusters of grapes on the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples. And she says, and your mouth like the best wine. May the wine go straight to my beloved, flowing gently over lips and teeth. I belong to my beloved, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. That's smoking. It's a rare thing for us, actually, to hear those texts on a Sunday, and it's a rare thing, in fact, for us to open the Song of Songs. Go home and read them. They're beautiful. It's beautiful love poetry. And theologians have pored over those texts and understand, in fact, from whichever point of view you come from, that partly it's about talking about sexuality, but it's also about spirituality. That's always in the context of a relationship with God. That there is a subtleness and an obvious nature in the way that we talk about spirituality and we talk about sexuality as somehow going together. There is such an intimacy. Intimacy from Latin, intimus, deep inside. When in the New Testament, Paul in one point says, if you have to take a wife, then you have to take a wife. But it's not necessary. He also believed that the end of the world was coming. He did say this in Ephesians. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is the great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Paul did not see disunity. He saw all things flowing biologically and spiritually all together. Often we say to know someone biblically. To know is also code for sexual intercourse, sexual intimacy, to know. But what's also implied in knowledge and knowing is a covenant. That when we talk about sexuality in the heart of the biblical text, both in the New Testament and the Old Testament, is always held in the sense of a covenant. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks says this, in a covenant, two or more individuals, each respecting the dignity and integrity of the other, come together in a bond of love and trust to share their interests, sometimes even to share their lives, by pledging their faithfulness to one another, to do together what neither can achieve alone. A covenant is a relationship. A covenant is about identity. It is about you and me coming together to form an us. That is why contracts benefit, but covenants transform. Covenant is a key word of the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, where it occurs more than 250 times. A covenant is a betrothal, a bond of love and trust. When we hear in the biblical text talking about knowing, about flesh, about loin, about feet, it's always held in the context of a sense of being in covenant, of two people or one person in covenant with God. In fact, when you go back into the book of Genesis, there's this wonderful moment in chapter 24 when Abraham sends his servant out to find a wife for his son, and he wants to make sure that he goes to the tribe of Israel. And the text says this, and Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his house, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh. Have you got the mental image? The sense was that there's an intimacy in the covenant that we make with each other. You hold my future literally in your hands. My seed, my future is in your hands. It is the basis of a testimony. It is the basis of how we make pledges to each other. There's an intimacy. From our 21st century perspective, we'd say, not on your life. on the other hand, when you think of our biblical, ancient biblical ancestors, they actually have it right when they speak about when we make intimate testimonies of pledging covenant with each other. This is how intimate it becomes. At the same time, the biblical text will speak often about taboos, or at least perceived taboos. The exposure of one's nakedness, as in the story of the sons of Noah. When Noah got off the boat, what's the first thing he did? He planted a vineyard. What's the second thing he did? He grew grapes. What's the third thing he did? He made wine. And what's the fourth thing? He got hammered. And he fell down, and his nakedness was uncovered. And his sons came in and saw him, and they were ashamed. There's always that sense of shame holding another's nakedness when you're not supposed to. David was denounced by his wife because he danced naked before the ark of the Lord. Incest in Leviticus, and we'll get a little bit more into this later, but incest in Leviticus is the prescribed heart of what thou shalt not do. Adulterous relationships are prohibited. There were rules about seducing a virgin. If you were caught up in war and you were female, you were allowed to be brought home by a soldier into a foreign land, and that you were allowed to live together for a whole month before you were to engage in any sexual intercourse whatsoever. Some of these texts you go, excuse me? And there's a good reason why we don't read them on a Sunday morning, because the preacher would have a long time trying to explain all of the bits and pieces. There are disconnects for us as we listen to our biblical ancestors wax eloquently about rules of engagement sexually, because we think somehow they have all the answers to the questions that we have. They don't necessarily know that we are here. And the original writers had one intent: to help a tribe keep going into the future. One of the pieces that the biblical texts are absolutely concerned about is survival. So when we talk about menstruation and blood and semen, you will hear constantly in the text of being able to preserve and keep and be careful with, because what you are holding literally is the future of a people. We often get stuck in the details. That's my minimalist hat on. We get stuck in the details as opposed to hearing in the texts a people who were bonded to God, who wished to survive in the worst of circumstances, and that they needed to be able to preserve life in their relationships with each other. Semen and blood were seen as life force. It's how you were to take care of the life force that is within. It's why when you slaughter animals, they need to be slaughtered in a particular way, because it is a sacred taking of life in order to keep a life. How you deal with the blood is important. For the last 25 years as a church, we have been talking about homosexuality, often lumping homosexuality in the long list of taboos. And it's taken us a very, very, very long time to wrestle down texts to say, is that really what these texts are saying? So a little light reading. What you have coming around is one of those paramount stories that you know, you and I know very well from the book of Genesis. Can you guess which one it is without looking at it? Sodom and Gomorrah. So when we talk about Sodom, we think about sodomy, and we think about a biblical text that talks for us about homosexuality, men engaged with having sex with other men. And this has been one of those linchpin texts that has been used down through time that has kind of helped us formulate our own understanding. So I'm going to use this text as one of those One of those examples of for me over the last 30 years is watching and participating in the long conversation of watching a church and a people of God integrate sexuality with spirituality, moving from the inside or the outside to the inside. And it's you'll hear your own peculiar position on biblical texts as we go through this. So read it from the fine print as a maximalist and as a minimalist. And I'll read it for you out loud. Then two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. He said, "Please, my lords, turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you can rise early and go on your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the square." But he urged them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house, and they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, so that we may know them." Lot went out of the door to the men, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you, and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they replied, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came here as an alien, and he would play the judge? Now we will deal worse with you than with them." Then they pressed hard against the man Lot, and came near the door to break it down. But the men inside reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the door of the house, both small and great, so that they were unable to find the door. Then the men said to Lot, Have you anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city? Bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place, because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. When morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Get up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or else you will be consumed in the punishment of the city." But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and left him outside the city. When they brought them outside, they said, "Flee for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the hills, or else you will be consumed." And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords, your servant has found favor with you, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot flee to the hills for fear the disaster will overtake me and I die. Look, that city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved." He said to him, "Very well, I grant you this favor too, and will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I can do nothing until you arrive there." Therefore the city was called Zoar. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord God rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and overthrew those cities and all the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt.